Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu. Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com.
Patient care, qualityhealthcare.org. From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Great narrative journalism is simultaneously subtle and attention-grabbing. It is the art of storytelling that grabs a reader or listener with one simple request. Pay attention to this and learn. Earlier this month, some of the country's best writers met in Cambridge, Massachusetts to share their best work at the 2003 Nieman Conference on Narrative Journalism. In this hour, we bring you a selection of their stories from across the country delivered in the authors' own voices. The conference was organized by Harvard University's Nieman Foundation for Journalism. We'll hear about five 13-year-old boys who start a band that inadvertently wins them seventh-grade fame, the story of a daughter losing her mother to alcoholism, the story of a father whose son finally begins to realize what it means to have brown skin. Tonight on Point, listening to the best of narrative journalism, up close and personal. We begin tonight with Susan Orlean, staff writer at The New Yorker magazine. Her book, The Orchid Thief, about orchid poachers in Florida, was recently made into the movie adaptation. She reads from a work in progress, an essay tribute to the in-flight shopping catalog, SkyMall.
One characteristic of the SkyMall customer seems to be an excess of body hair. In fact, as you wander through the 100 or so pages of the SkyMall catalog, you begin to suspect that its customers have luxuriant growth everywhere, sprouting out of their noses, ears, cheeks, legs, underarms, and what is always delicately referred to as the bikini area. In the world of SkyMall, though, hirsutism is not an obstacle. It is a challenging opportunity with interesting products coupled with it. Just look at last summer's issue of SkyMall. On page 23, there is the Turbo Groomer 5.0 with superior Swiss surgical stainless steel blades for those hard-to-reach nose and ear hairs. On page 42, an immersible long-use travel shaver for hair removal underwater. On page 74, the IGEA Forever Gone Plus, the permanent solution to hair removal. On page 81, the Discreet Plus by Epilady, which announces itself as always one step ahead in hair removal. There are also hair removal-associated products, such as the chrome-plated fog-free shower mirror and also the AM-FM shower radio with lighted mirror, which allows you to listen to traffic reports while you shower and shave, which satisfies another SkyMall trait, the desire to do more than one thing at a time, especially if one of the things you're doing is removing hair. I never used to think about hairiness on land or while flying, but then I began to read SkyMall religiously, and as a result, much of my airtime is now devoted to wondering if I have too much, and if I do, what means I should use to get rid of it. I also wonder, persistently, whether or not I should finally surrender and order myself a pop-up hot dog cooker, a solar-powered cascade fountain, or a jewelry organizer with 66 pockets, three SkyMall items I've thought about buying time after high-flying time. For me, SkyMall is the land of products I never think I want, serving needs I never thought I had, which I can't quite bring myself to buy, but can't help considering once they have been brought to my attention. I have dog-eared enough copies of SkyMall to fill a kennel. I fly all the time, and even on those overscheduled days when I fly somewhere in the morning and somewhere else in the afternoon, I always pull SkyMall out of the seat pocket and browse through it. Each time, it is as if everything in it, every brass guest towel holder and hand-painted Russian balalaika and fold-away closet ladder and pocket peppermill, were something I had never seen before and now seem almost, but not quite, like something I should buy. SkyMall is a weird entity. It is a go-between that packages other mail-order companies and offers them in a virtual shopping mall in the virtual megalopolis of the sky. In the trade, it is known as a multi-channel specialty retailer. It actually has no products of its own. It doesn't produce anything or manufacture anything or even customize anything it offers for sale. Its closest precedent is probably the Yankee Peddler. SkyMall is offered in some hotel rooms, airport lounges, and Amtrak trains, but its singular microenvironment is the airline seat pocket, that grimy pouch where it is tucked between the evacuation slide instruction card and the airsickness bag and whatever previous traveler's rubbish the ground crew failed to clean out. I began reading SkyMall during a period in my life when I had developed a ferocious fear of flying. Because of the itinerant nature of my work, I have to travel all the time, regardless of the state of my nerves. Like all sissy flyers, I gorged on jet disaster news, became fluent in traffic controller lingo, and developed diagnostic genius regarding aircraft thumps and rattles. During takeoffs and landings, in particular, I was very busy assisting the pilot. At the same time, of course, I was scared witless and needed to keep myself busy, or I would have jumped out the window or clawed whoever was unfortunate enough to be seated next to me as soon as something set me off. I always arm myself with dozens of magazines and books, but who can concentrate on actual reading when at any moment she might be called upon to pull a 767-200 jumbo jet out of a nosedive? And how many times can you read and retrace the exit door diagrams? No, the reading I wanted to do during my flying hysteria days was not actual reading. I just wanted to paw through something, the pages sticking slightly to my clammy hands while running my eyeballs over text. This is how I discovered and grew to deeply love SkyMall. Nothing was better suited to distracting me than a publication that rhapsodized about telescoping cobweb dusters and tan-through swimsuits and deluxe digital massage booths. Thank you.
That was New Yorker magazine staff writer and author Susan Orlean. Next up is Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Jackie Bonashinsky, associate managing editor for special projects at the Seattle Times. In this reading, she tells the story of a man who escaped a gas explosion through the back door of his house with one of his daughters. His wife and second daughter tried to escape through the front door of the house and perished.
A small burn mars the tan on Donald Spano's forearm. It is where he cradled his daughter's head when he carried her from the fiery front yard to the cool grass behind the house. It's from her hair, not much more than a contact burn, really, he says. Physically, the burn is all that lingers of the day, almost 2 weeks ago, when a gas pipeline explosion ripped through Spano's life, killing his wife, Beverly, and their youngest child, Jennifer, and forever changing things for him and his surviving daughter, Allison. The light burn, probably not bad enough to scar, gives no hint of deeper wounds inflicted that day, a day Spano simply refers to as the 8th. I'll never be the same person I was 2 weeks ago Monday, he says. That's not fatalistic, just realistic. Everything else seems normal, even peaceful, at the comfortable home on Woodcrest Drive in Mounds View. Jennifer's ducks, Timmy and Laverne, paddle sedately in the pond that edges the backyard. A woman's shampoo bottles and lotions cluster the vanity in the bathroom that Spano shared with his wife, but that was clearly, he says, Bev's domain. The books and games and dolls of a 7-year-old brighten the white shelves of Jennifer's room, and more dolls are tucked into plastic crates in her closet, waiting until small hands reach out and bring them back to life. Allison 8 fidgets in her father's lap as he talks to visitors, interrupting with occasional questions or skipping off to find her toys when she gets bored. It seems no different than other afternoons with Beverly Spano and Jennifer out on one of their legendary shopping sprees. The house and those in it seem to be waiting for them to come home. But there is that burn in the crook of Don Spano's arm where Jennifer rested her head for the last time. And a patch of burned grass discolors the neighbor's lawn, as if kissed by a bit too much sun. It is where Spano found his wife and daughter after the flash. We had discussed death, but always mine because of my job. It's not the safest job in the world, says Spano, 35, a switchman for the Chicago and Northwestern Transportation Company. Only fools think they're infallible and never going to die. It is the first interview he's granted since the explosion, a way to respond to the sympathy cards that have poured in from around the country, to acknowledge the keen public interest in his family's tragedy, and to announce plans to sue the Williams Pipeline Company and the manufacturer of the ruptured pipe. Allison stays close to him as he talks, clinging to his arm or nestling in his lap. He pads through the plush carpet in bare feet. The blisters he suffered from running along the burning streets that morning have since healed. Spano brought Allison home the day after the explosion. It is here they will continue their lives together, learning anew how to be a family. Spano will return to work soon, and Allison will start third grade at nearby Sunnyside Elementary School. This is our home, and I love it, Spano says. It's the accumulation of 3 houses and 13 years of marriage. The ugliness of a few moments hasn't overshadowed the fun times we've had here. The Spanos moved to the modern split-level house from Fridley just a few years ago. Beverly Spano had redecorated it to her family's needs and tastes. Decks line the back, overhanging a sloping lawn and White Oak Lake, a spring-fed pond surrounded by similar homes and friendly neighbors. In 15 years, their mortgage would be paid, the girls would be through college, and Don and Bev Spano would just be turning 50. This was going to be it, Spano said. It was kind of our Walden's pond out here. It had everything we thought we'd need for the rest of our lives. Monday, July 7th, dawned bright and cheerful in Mounds View. The Spano family was settling back into routine after their annual summer vacation. A few days of luckless fishing up north, then a trip to Wisconsin Dells, riding the duck boats and watching the water ski show, before coming home for the July 4th weekend. Allison spent the holiday with friends. Jennifer tagged along with her parents while they shopped for dining room chairs. Spano had been assigned a swing shift that week and went to work at 3 p.m. He got home well before midnight. Allison and Jennifer were in bed. His wife was still up, so the couple talked for about an hour before going to bed themselves. The night was warm, and they left the French doors open to the backyard. Everything was completely normal, Spano says. Early the next morning, they were awakened by an explosion that Spano said sounded like a cannon. The smell of gas and smoke poured into the open doors. Across the pond, flames danced above the trees. They had no way of knowing a natural gas main had erupted, and their instinctive response, Spano says, was to get out of the house. You just say, let's grab the kids and go, he says. It took me long enough to get a pair of pants on. Bev didn't bother. She was in her nightgown. The kids were, too. Jennifer's room was just down the hall from theirs. Beverly Spano grabbed the tiny girl, then ran to the downstairs bedroom where Allison usually slept. When his wife yelled that she couldn't find Allison, Donald Spano went straight to the living room. As was her habit, Allison had crept out of bed sometime during the night to sleep on the couch near her parents. As Spano was waking Allison, his wife rushed back upstairs, hand in hand with Jennifer. The two ran out the entrance to the top of the stairs into the front yard. The steel door closed behind them. Spano followed soon after with Allison, but when he yanked the front door open, he was met by a wall of smoke. He ran with his daughter back through the house, out onto the deck, and down the stairs towards the pond. Allie was terrified, Spano said. She kept running back and forth between the lake and the house, yelling for her mom and me. In the process of calming her down is when the flash happened. I could see it down at the lake. It lit everything up. And I could hear the screams, so I knew where to look. He doesn't avoid the questions, but when they get too painful, his answers come slowly, and sometimes are no more than a word or two. Was he able to get to them? Yes. Was he the first one there? Yes. Was there anything he could do? A pause this time, then finally, no.
Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Jackie Bonaschinsky of the Seattle Times. She's also the Knight Chair in Journalism at the Missouri School of Journalism. More readings after a short break. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're listening tonight to top American journalists reading their works at the 2003 Nieman Conference on Narrative Journalism. Next up is Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Thomas French, staff writer at the St. Petersburg Times. Here he reads from a series he co-wrote called 13. In this excerpt, he profiles a group of 13-year-old boys who form a band and inadvertently find seventh-grade fame.
The Legend of the Pink Dinos begins on a sun-drenched afternoon in spring. It begins, oddly enough, with standardized tests and cringing mothers and a host of spontaneously combusting middle school girls. To be precise, the legend is born just after 1 p.m. on Wednesday, March 13th, 2002, when five scrawny seventh-grade boys take the stage inside Booker T's lunchroom. The band members' names, soon to be emblazoned in the pages of school history, are Brett, Sean, Ricky, Gio, and Cameron. They have guitars. They have attitude. Most of them do not yet have girlfriends, but they're working on it. Ricky Reed and Gio Molina, the band's two lead vocalists, are doing their utmost with the lyrics to Chick Magnet, a song by a group called MXPX. But they can't quite keep the beat, and they appear to be singing not just out of tune, but out of sync with each other. Doesn't matter in the slightest. Out in the audience, the band's performance is triggering ecstasy. The students up front, virtually all of them female, are bouncing up and down and waving their arms and asking the band to please marry them. Ricky and Gio flash shy smiles and just keep singing. For 3 days now, every student at Booker T has been suffering through the annual ordeal of state-required tests known as the FCATs. If you don't know what the acronym stands for, don't ask. The answer is so dull that to merely read it would suck away a tiny but irreplaceable portion of your immortal soul. Now, on this Wednesday afternoon, the test-taking is finally over. And in the spirit of the moment, the school administration has agreed to sponsor a concert of celebration, a concert of liberation, really, featuring none other than the Pink Dinos. This is the band's first public performance. For a long time, Ricky and Gio and their cohorts were like so many other young, testosterone-laden males, wandering through their days and nights in lonely obscurity. They were nice boys, no question, all of them fairly presentable. A few rudimentary social skills, a certain puppy charm, but nothing flashy. Then the Pink Dinos launched their practices down in Booker T's band room. Brett and a couple of the other guys, Sean Simpson and Cameron Jones, were already part of the school band, and Mr. Dixon, the band's director, gave them permission to rehearse during lunch period as long as they kept things from getting out of hand. The Pink Dinos began to work up cover versions of some of their favorite songs by groups like Blink-182, Green Day, and Five Iron Frenzy. Brett, the lead guitarist, practiced the chord changes he downloaded on his computer. Ricky and Gio were brought in to handle the vocals. Sean took over at bass. Cameron played drums and came up with the band's name, which he borrowed from a logo on a skateboarding website. From the onset, the Pink Dinos did not bill themselves as a rock band. If anyone asked, they said they were, quote, a punk and ska band. They liked ska, they said, because it was upbeat and happy. And while they admired the energy of punk music, they weren't quite ready to embrace the rage. When they began working on Damn It, a Blink 182 song, they automatically changed the title, without a word from any adult, to Darn It. In many ways, they were just like any other up-and-coming group on the verge of their big break. They had many tiffs and subtle tensions. They shared French fries and Willy Wonka Chewy rolls. Whenever possible, they messed with each other's minds. "What do you call people who hang out with musicians?" Brett asked Cameron one day. "No," said Cameron, who already knew the answer. A big grin from Brett. "Drummers." "Come on," said Cameron, raising his fist in faint fury. "Bring it." By the time they were given permission to play at the FCAT concert, the Pink Dinos were coming together as a band. They had the requisite banter. They could reasonably fake their way through 6 or 7 songs. Word of their progress quickly spread. Soon a line of girls began to hang out in the band room at lunchtime, sighing heavily and gazing on with doe eyes. Other boys, sensing critical mass, clamored to join the group. Brett and the others didn't really need anybody else, but in the interest of spreading the love, they officially designated a couple of their closest friends as, quote, backup guitarists. Some of the Pink Dino's most devoted followers, not surprisingly, have been their parents. For the past few days, knowing that their sons would be performing in front of the whole school, several of the mothers have been negotiating for clearance to attend. "You're not coming," Sean was saying to his mom just this morning. "Tell me you're not coming." "I'll be really quiet," she promised. "I won't talk to you at all." Now the boys are on stage, blinking together under the lights as they tear through a 15-minute set that includes not just Chick Magnet, but also Island in the Sun and Damn It, well, Darn It, and a little number called Undone. In honor of the moment, Ricky and Gio have dyed the tops of their hair pink. Their hair is far better coordinated than their singing. Still, it provides just enough of an edge. Against all odds, the Pink Dinos are coming across as slightly rebellious. Sean's mom and other Pink Dino moms are gathered in the back, fighting the urge to let their mouths drop open. They love their boys, adore them, admire them for having the guts to get up there and play. But to their adult ears, the Pink Dinos sound, well, like seventh graders stumbling through their first gig. And yet a sizable portion of the audience is going certifiably wild. Girls are emitting high-pitched cries and climbing onto their chairs and dancing and tossing their hair back and forth. Some are waving signs and banners. "Pink Dinos rule. Cameron is dreamy. Kiss me, baby. You guys are so hot. I want to have your baby, Ricky." Ricky's mother, Carla Reed... Ricky's mother, Carla Reed, is not ready to be a grandmother just yet. Thank you. But as the hysteria builds around her, she realizes that she and the other moms are witnessing a fundamental shift in the landscape of their sons' young lives. Mrs. Reed pulls out her cell phone and calls her husband at his office. When he answers, she holds up the phone. Rich Reed can't hear Ricky singing. He can't hear Brett's guitar. He can't hear Sean's bass. What Mr. Reed can make out through the din is wave after wave of who knows how many females screaming for his little boy. Thank you.
Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Thomas French, staff writer at the St. Petersburg Times in Florida. Sonia Nazario is projects reporter for the Los Angeles Times. Tonight she reads from her story, Enrique's Journey, which won this year's Pulitzer Prize for feature reporting. The story profiles a Honduran boy's struggle to be reunited with his mother in the U.S. In this passage, Sonia Nazario describes a harrowing encounter during Enrique's 7th attempt to find his mother.
It is night. He is riding on top of a freight train. A stranger climbs up the side of the tanker car and asks for a cigarette. Trees hide the moon, and Enrique does not see two men who are behind the stranger or three more creeping up on the other side of the car. Scores of migrants cling to the train, but no one is within shouting distance. One of the men reaches a grate where Enrique is sitting. He grabs Enrique with both hands. Someone seizes him from behind. They slam him face down. All six surround him. "Take off everything," one says. Another swings a wooden club. It cracks into the back of Enrique's head. "Hurry," someone demands. The club smacks his face. Enrique feels someone yank off his shoes. Hands paw through his pants pockets. One of the men pulls out a small scrap of paper. It has his mother's telephone number on it. Without it, he has no way to locate her. The man tosses the paper into the air. Enrique sees it flutter away. The men pull off his pants. His mother's number is inked inside the waistband. But there is little money. Enrique has less than 50 pesos on him, only a few coins that he has gathered begging. The men curse and fling the pants overboard. The blows land harder. "Don't kill me," Enrique pleads. His cap flies away. Someone rips off his shirt. Another blow finds the left side of his face. It shatters three teeth. They rattle like broken glass in his mouth. One of the men stands over Enrique, straddling him. He wraps the sleeve of a jacket around Enrique's neck and starts to twist. Enrique wheezes, coughs, and gasps for air. His hands move feverishly from his neck to his face, and he tries to breathe and buffer the blows. "Throw him off the train," one man yells. Enrique thinks of his mother. He will be buried in an unmarked grave, and she will never know what happened. "Please," he asks God, "don't let me die without seeing her again." The man with the jacket slips. The noose loosens. Enrique struggles to his knees. He has been stripped of everything but his underwear. He manages to stand, and he runs along the top of the fuel car, desperately trying to balance on the smooth, curved surface. Loose tracks flail the train from side to side. There are no lights. He can barely see his feet. He stumbles, then regains his footing. In half a dozen strides, he reaches the rear of the car. The train is rolling at nearly 40 miles per hour. The next car is another fuel tanker. Leaping from one to the other at such speeds would be suicidal. Enrique knows he could slip, fall between them, and be sucked under. He hears the men coming. Carefully, he jumps down onto the coupler that holds the cars together, just inches from the hot, churning wheels. He hears the muffled pop of gunshots and knows what he must do. He leaps from the train, flinging himself outward into the black void.
Sonia Nazario of the Los Angeles Times. Her story, Enrique's Journey, won this year's Pulitzer Prize for feature reporting. Journalist and author Adrienne Nicole LeBlanc has won critical acclaim for her best-selling book, Random Family, Love, Drugs, Trouble, and Coming of Age in the Bronx. In this excerpt, a reprise of a reading she did at last year's conference, she introduces us to a teenage girl, Jessica, and her mother, Lourdes, who live in the South Bronx.
Jessica lived on Tremont Avenue, one of the poorer blocks in a very poor section of the Bronx. She dressed even to go to the store. Chance was opportunity in the ghetto, and you had to be prepared for anything. She didn't have much of a wardrobe, but she was resourceful with what she had: her sister's Lee jeans, her best friend's earrings, her mother's T-shirts and perfume. Her appearance on the streets in her neighborhood usually caused a stir. A 16-year-old Puerto Rican girl with bright hazel eyes, a huge, inviting smile, and a voluptuous shape, she radiated intimacy wherever she went. You could be talking to her in the middle of the bustle of Tremont and feel as if lovers' confidences were being exchanged beneath a tent of sheets. Guys in cars offered rides, grown men got stupid, women pursed their lips, and boys made promises they could not keep. Jessica was good at attracting boys, but less good at holding on to them. She fell in love hard and fast. She desperately wanted to be somebody's real girlfriend, but she always ended up the other girl, the mistress, the one they saw on the down low, the girl nobody claimed. Boys called up to her window after they dropped off their main girls, the steady ones they referred to as wives. Jessica still had her fun, but her fun was somebody else's trouble. And for a wild girl at the dangerous age, the trouble could get big. It was the mid-80s, and the drug trade on East Tremont was brisk. The avenue marks the north end of the South Bronx, running east to west. Jessica lived just off the Grand Concourse, which bisects the Bronx lengthwise. Her mother's tenement apartment overlooked an underpass. Car stereos thudded and Spanish radio tunes drifted down from windows. On corners, boys stood draped in gold bracelets and chains. Children munched on the takeout that the dealers had bought them, balancing the styrofoam trays of greasy food on their knees. Grandmothers pushed strollers. Young mothers leaned on strollers they'd parked so they could concentrate on flirting, their irresistible babies providing excellent introductions and much-needed entertainment. All along the avenue, working people shopped and dragged home bags of groceries or pushed wheel carts of meticulously folded laundry. Drug customers skulked through the crowd, copped, and skulked away again. The streets that loosely bracketed Jessica's world, Tremont and Anthony, Anthony and Echo, Mount Hope and Anthony, Mount Hope and Monroe, were some of the hottest drug-dealing blocks in the notorious 46th Precinct. The same stretch of Tremont had been good to Jessica's family. Lourdes, Jessica's mother, had moved from Manhattan with a violent boyfriend, hoping the Bronx might give the troubled relationship a fresh start. That relationship soon ended, but a new place still meant new possibility. One afternoon, Jessica stopped by Ultra Fine Meats for Lourdes, and the butcher asked her out. Jessica was 14 at the time. He was 25. Jessica replied that she was too young for him, but that her 32-year-old mother was pretty and available. It took the butcher 7 tries before Lourdes agreed to a date. 2 months later, he moved in, and the children called him Big Daddy. Almost immediately, the household resumed a schedule. Lourdes prepared Big Daddy's breakfast and sent him off to work. Everyone, Robert, Jessica, Elaine, and Caesar, went to school. Lourdes cleaned house and had the evening meal cooked and waiting on the stove by noon. Big Daddy seemed to love Lourdes. On weekends, he took her bowling, dancing, or out to City Island for dinner. And he accepted her 4 children. He bought them clothes, invited them to softball games, and drove them upstate for picnics at Bear Mountain. He behaved as though they were a family. Jessica and her older brother, Robert, had the same father who had died when Jessica was 3, but he had never accepted Jessica as his. Now only Robert maintained a close relationship with the father's relatives. Elaine, Jessica's younger sister, had her own father, whom she sometimes visited on weekends. Caesar's father accepted him. Caesar had his last name on the birth certificate, but he was a drug dealer with other women and other kids. Occasionally, he passed by Lourdes's. Sometimes Caesar went to stay with him, and during those visits, Caesar would keep him company on the street. Caesar's father put him to work. "Here," he would say, passing Caesar vials of crack taped together, "hold this." Drug charges didn't stick to children, but Big Daddy cautioned Caesar about the lifestyle when he returned home. "Don't follow his lead. If anybody's lead you're going to follow, it should be mine." Big Daddy spoke to Caesar's teachers when Caesar had problems in school. Jessica considered Big Daddy a stepfather, an honor she had not bestowed upon any of her mother's other men. But even Jessica and Caesar's affection for Big Daddy could not keep them inside. Thank you.
Adrienne Nicole LeBlanc, reading from her best-selling book, Random Family, Love, Drugs, Trouble, and Coming of Age in the Bronx. We'll hear more readings from the 2003 Nieman Conference on Narrative Journalism after a short break. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're listening tonight to writers and their stories told through the craft of narrative journalism. Cynthia Gorney is Associate Dean at the University of California's Berkeley Graduate School of Journalism and a former staff writer for The Washington Post. In this personal essay, she shares the heartbreak of watching her mother die of alcoholism.
In my mother's hospital room, there was a single window, and if you stood before the window, you could see the aerial bridge. In Minnesota, this is a famous bridge, often photographed on postcards, and around the bridge stretched Lake Superior, flat and pearled and vast as the sea. My mother told me over the telephone that she had a view of the lake. I was standing in my kitchen in California and willing my voice not to crack. You checked into the hospital 5 days ago without letting any of us know, I said carefully into the telephone, and when she answered me back, I thought stupidly for a moment, she is drunk in the hospital. How can she be drunk in the hospital? I don't want you to come, said my mother, thickly, making herself sound jolly. I wouldn't know what to do with you. I just got tired of feeling sick. My stomach hurt. I was coughing so much. The nurses are nice. I have a view of the lake. All of this took place in the spring, just a little while ago, and I am writing about it now because I want you to know what happens when someone you love dies of alcoholism. I'm not going to preach or call in the sociologists or heave around a lot of numbers and research theories and Alcoholics Anonymous advice. I did that when my mother was alive, in my own scrabbling way, and while I did it, my mother went on drinking. She drank quietly and discreetly in the privacy of her pleasantly cluttered home. She was active in her church and traveled internationally and volunteered on committees to help the homeless and care for Latin American refugees. She read prodigiously and wrote in three languages and had friends in places like León, Nicaragua, and Harbin, China. You can see that she was a woman of curiosity and learning and great intelligence. She died in March of cirrhosis of the liver, which is also what kills the men under blankets by the sewer grates. I want you to know this, because if you are like me or like my mother, you think you know it, but you don't, not really. You don't know that when an educated lady in her 60s has cirrhosis of the liver, she will be lying in a hospital bed near the oncology wing, and that when you get off the elevator, the nurses will come toward you quickly because they need to prepare you for what you are about to see. You don't know that your first glimpse into the open door of the hospital room will be of skin, the skin of a leg or an arm. You can't tell which because the skin is green, and it seems impossible that this could, in fact, be human skin. There must be makeup involved or some malfunction of hospital lighting. The nurses are murmuring around you that she looks pretty bad right now, and the body shifts position, and you see that it is not bad lighting after all. This is what cirrhosis does to the human body. Before it kills you, it turns you ochre green. I wish somebody had told my mother that before it happened to her. She was unbearably thirsty, and for the first few days, when they thought she might recover, they gave her water only in tiny sips. When my brothers and I arrived, she asked us to sneak her some water. I suppose the irony of this request was not lost on any of us, because my mother had never asked us to sneak her alcohol. In our house, the gin and vodka bottles were delivered by the grocery boy and left just as seamlessly in the household garage, having been emptied in dignified fashion into large glasses with slices of lime. My mother never drove erratically or beat us with hairbrushes or acted like one of the crazy women in the movie star exposés. It was only after she went through the residential treatment program and kept drinking anyway that she began hiding her bottles, putting them under her clothes in the bottom of the suitcase when she came to visit. She never talked about it. When we tried to talk about it, she waved her hand and changed the subject, and we sat moving our mouths noiselessly behind the thick glass wall that she had pulled from the air and jammed into the ground between herself and the rest of us. She was able to do this because we were her children and made ourselves too small to beat it down. In the hospital, she wore an eye patch when we arrived, but by the second day, the nurses had taken it off, and we saw that one eye looked as though it had exploded from inside. Apparently, this was not one of the things that hurt her, but a spidery web of blood had spread across the eyeball, and it was difficult to look at her face without staring at the bad eye. Her belly was swollen where the fluids were building up. Her skin was loose around her bones, crepey and soft and green. When I stroked her head, her hair seemed very shiny and black to me, and I remember thinking that this was the only part of her that held what looked like life, the hair on the top of her head. The doctor was a resident who seemed desperately young with his unsmiling face and the circles under his eyes. He took my brothers and me into a small room with a table and told us that the alcohol had turned our mother's liver into something like a piece of leather. He said livers are remarkably resilient and that some people are able to survive with only a portion of the liver left, so that if they had gotten hold of my mother earlier, the doctors might have been able to save her, but that now the liver had ceased any function at all and this was shutting down her kidneys and causing peritonitis, systemic collapse, cardiac exhaustion, various other medical details I was working to follow. The resident said it would take a few days for her to die, perhaps longer, and that if we were able to do it, we might wish to use this time to say goodbye in a way that felt appropriate to us. When he left the room, my brothers and I stood with our arms around each other's shoulders and our heads pressed together like a tripod. We had done this in the residential treatment program, which was the only other time, since we were grown, that I had seen my brothers cry. We called her priest, who was a tough-faced Episcopalian with short black hair and a strong handshake. He told us he was a recovering alcoholic and listened to me without saying anything when I stood in the hallway with my hands jammed into my pockets and said, I don't understand. I have never understood why she couldn't ask for help. She went into the program because she was hallucinating, and as soon as she stopped hallucinating, the wall came back down and nobody ever busted through again, I said to the priest. And the priest said, I know. That is how alcoholism works. The disease keeps you from naming the disease, said my mother's priest. You're so deep inside it that you can't pick up the telephone and pronounce the words, help me. The priest described standing at a room at a party when he was drinking and seeing that across the room was a man from Alcoholics Anonymous, and the priest just went on standing there, he said, knowing he was sick, knowing this man had a kind of medicine that could cure him, and being unable to walk toward this man and speak. That is the disease, the priest said. I could not do it. In the afternoon, we moved my mother to the hospice where the patients go to die. There's a lot more I could tell you. Some of it is about the passages that I understand lie before each of us, the last letting go of a hand too tired to squeeze back, and some of it is about the sound of the breath of a person whose liver is like a piece of leather. In the hospital halls, it was possible to hear my mother's breathing two rooms away. When she inhaled, there was a small moan, and when she exhaled, there was a louder moan. I had to walk some distance down the hall, past the oncology wing, to leave the sound of the breaths. At the end of the hall was a room with a curtainless window and a wide view of the lake, and that was where I was when a nurse came to tell me that I needed to go to my mother's room. When she put her hand on my elbow to steady me, I knew that my mother had died, and I'm telling you this because nobody told it to me, that alcohol was killing her, not in the sorrowful, metaphorical way that children of alcoholics talk about in their emotional deprivation groups, but precisely and literally, and in such a way that for the last 3 days of her life, she had green skin and a bloodied eye and made a terrible noise every time she breathed. I want someone else to hear this. I want to imagine that in a pleasantly cluttered house somewhere, there is a man or a woman who doesn't know, truly doesn't know, and could read about my mother and say, now I do. My mother would have raged at me for shaming her in public, for that is how she would have thought of it. She was a proud woman, and I believe she died frightened and too ashamed to repeat aloud the name of the illness that killed her. I repeat it for her now, alcoholism. Alcoholism-induced cirrhosis of the liver, alcoholism-induced peritonitis, followed by renal failure, followed by cardiac arrest. If one person sees these words and picks up the telephone and asks for help, my betrayal will have been worthwhile.
Cynthia Gorney is Associate Dean at the University of California, Berkeley's Graduate School of Journalism. We close tonight's reading with Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Victor Marina. He reads from the essay, For My Son Who Will Choose Who He Is.
There is wonder to a child's questions, that open-faced innocence, the inquisitive smile, the slack-mouthed eagerness to hear your answer. All ears, all heart, tell me, please, why do the waves keep coming back? How can those tiny crabs breathe in the wet sand? Why is the water so salty? Why can't I go out farther? What's a riptide? There are a child's questions as he crouches on the beach, the late summer sun spilling over the horizon. There is the onset of school in the air, the approaching sense of autumn, when the well-tanned youths around him will see their skin color fade. But for now, there is the beach and the surf and a boy's curiosity that fills a father's thoughts, each question making him gladly riffle through his mental encyclopedia in search of the right answer. Until the one question comes leaping out of his son's mouth, and the query makes him feel the undertow of seawater tugging at his ankles, and the pull of each outgoing wave draining the sand around his feet. Momentarily unbalanced, the father finds himself nearly swept away by the onrushing words. Daddy, he hears his young son say, why are we always so dark? In truth, Dorian is not the dark-skinned one. His shade of color is light brown, made richer and deeper by the summer's exposure to the Southern California sun. His hair is almost auburn, with reddish tints, and curls beneath his neck, almost in the ringlets of his toddler days. His eyes are light brown, and in many ways, He's a permanently tanned version of his mother, who has light brown hair, light-colored eyes, and the white skin of her Irish-German heritage. I am the dark-skinned one, with a hue inherited from my Filipino mother and father, along with my dark brown eyes. I have long black hair, now flecked with sand, and after hearing the question, I make a ritual of leaning over to rinse myself as I search for a way to explain this carefully and honestly and with meaning to a young boy. Actually, I tell him as he joins me in the surf, Roy has much darker skin than we do. I say this lightly, and I can see the smile stretch across Dorian's face. Roy is one of his favorite people, the father of his best friend, Janai, and he loves any reference to their family, but particularly to Roy, who is a tall, dreadlocked, native-born Jamaican whose size can fill a doorway and whose laughter can fill a house. Roy's skin is naturally deep brown, but as a boatwright who loves the sea and the outdoors, it can turn to near blackness that is as polished and as rich as some of the expensive ebony aboard the vessels he works. Bringing up Roy, of course, is a way to buy time and to think again about the talk I've been preparing since Dorian was born. The question was inevitable for a boy surrounded by children with blonde hair and fair skin in one of these affluent California beach cities, where diversity is considered more likely a debate over the make and color of late model automobiles than the makeup and color of everyday people. Or, if considered at all, where people of color are often the ones pushing the baby strollers, tending the gardens, and cleaning the office buildings mushrooming across the South Bay. When Dorian was born, his mother and I had given him the middle name Sanai, because we were searching for something to connect to his Asian heritage. The other suggestions we had in mind did not seem to fit. Family names, Filipino names, symbolic names. But Sanai, discovered during one of our late night sessions, poring over books and thinking about this unborn baby, seemed to cling to this infant now cradled in his mother's arms. And as I leaned over the bed to join them, I placed my hand next to baby and mother and could see that Dorian's color was a blend of his parents, the meeting ground of white and brown. It would be a game we often would play. As he grew up, Dorian and his sisters would place their arms between their mother's arm and mine, exulting triumphantly, "See, our color is exactly in between you two." And they would scurry off. It became a touchstone for them, a momentary resting spot in their frenetic day, a chance to marvel at how they were the offspring of two so distinctly different people. As they grew up, we would talk about our differing backgrounds, our heritage, our cultures, and as parents, we tried not to indoctrinate, but to allow the children to see this in the fabric of our lives, in the importance of ourselves. But on this beach, on this day, the question of dark skin was understandable. In their own words and in their own time, his sisters had asked the same question. For much of their lives, they were surrounded by whiteness, in school, on the soccer field, in dance class, at the store, at the movies, on the beach. They stood out in school pictures, in team photos, in group snapshots along the sand. You could always pick out our children, their brown hair and brown skin, unmistakable in the sea of white. When Dorian asked, "Why were we so dark?" he was really asking, "Why are we so different?"
Victor Marina is a senior fellow at the Southern California Annenberg Institute for Justice and Journalism. He shared a Pulitzer Prize in 1993 as a reporter for the Los Angeles Times for spot news coverage of the LA riots. Tonight, he read from his essay, "For My Son, Who Will Choose Who He Is." Join On Point tomorrow night for part two in our broadcast of readings from the 2003 Nieman Conference on Narrative Journalism. Special thanks tonight to Mark Kramer at the Nieman Foundation for Journalism and to Buck Ewing at Cambridge Transcriptions. For more information about the conference, visit our website at onpointradio.org. I'm Tom Ashby.